Hi, welcome everybody, thank you. I must say, when I was listening to the presentation before, just all the memories came back to me, and I don't think I have to say much. You guys are actually teaching yourselves and sharing your experiences, which is fantastic. So Tony's asked me to come along today and speak about that probably earlier topic, I think, go that way, how to set your business up to run without you. But one of the things that I want to challenge our thinking on is, and this is something I've dealt with, is am I the best person to be running my business? And that's a pretty challenging kind of thought when we set our businesses up because we're great technicians, we love plumbing, and all of a sudden we've created this beast, we've built ourselves a job, and we end up stuck in the office, or supposed to be in the office when we really want to get out in the field, and that's exactly me. So I thought I'd just tell you a little bit about me, who I am, my journey in business, and some lessons I learned along the way. And then I really want to spend a bit of time talking about what the shareholders want, because we're all typically shareholders in our own businesses. And it's something we don't spend enough time talking about or thinking about. And then, of course, stepping out of your business, if that's what you want to do, and that could be preparing it for sale, it could be putting a manager in charge, even just taking a different aspect, starting a new business. And then governance reporting, but that could equally be management reporting. So I thought I'd tell you a bit about myself first. Here's my family. So I've got a pretty big family. Actually, I must admit that's quite an old photo. I like this photo because there's one less kid there because I've got an extra one since then. This is about 6 years old, I think, this photo. And some of those bigger ones are all teenagers now, and teenagers are terrible and noisy, and they cost a lot more money, and particularly when you've got eight of them in total. So look, my background is I'm a certified plumber, gas fitter and drain layer. I've still got my license. I keep it intact because I'm using it in my flow consulting business. I own a company in Hamilton called CF Reece Plumbing, which I retired from 5 years ago when I turned 40. I always used to say to my wife when I was working those ridiculous long 60, 80-hour weeks, don't worry, Sarah, I'm going to retire when I'm 40 and I'll be around to help with the kids, because I was absolutely never around for the kids when they were younger, never there. So I did retire when I was 40, but I never actually really planned on retiring, and I never thought I'd step back out of my business. It was just something I'd said to appease her, actually, like some of you probably did. But my circumstances changed and my passions changed, and that's what I want to share with you today about my story, because it's a bloody hard job running your own business. It's pretty lonely at times, and it's a really can be often a feeling of being trapped. You've got this business, it's your livelihood, it's your investment, and what do? You can't go and apply for another job, can you? You've got to keep working. So I own CF Reece Plumbing today. We've got a general manager running it. It wasn't an easy thing to do. I'm going to share my experience about stepping out of CF Reece, I couldn't be happier now how it's running. Now, I say I retired when I was 40. That might seem like I was at the beach with this company and sitting back fishing all day. It wasn't. I didn't retire because I had so much money I could retire. I retired because my focus had shifted, and I wasn't enjoying my job anymore, my job as a manager of my company. And I wasn't the best person to be running it at that point in time. And I had all these other things I wanted to do, and owning my own business was stopping me from doing it. And it was really creating me some challenges. So today I spend some of my time working in a new company I started, Flow Consulting. Now that company started by accident. My board chairman at the time said to me, and you're going to hear me talk about governance a little bit because it's part of my journey, the governance and how I've transitioned out of my business. But my board chairman said to me, Aaron, when you step out of this business, you're going to have to do something else. You need to go and start another one so you don't come back and interfere with this one here that you've put your manager in. And I'll talk about that process today too, because it's a real big issue when you're putting management into roles. So I started Flow Consulting, and Flow Consulting is a hydraulic design consultancy practice, does plumbing design and compliance work. Like I said, it started as a bit of a hobby, but now it's sort of spread out a little bit, and we service architects and developers and other plumbers right throughout New Zealand from our Waikato base. We work in the virtual world and plans and AutoCAD and Rivet and BIM, but we basically design building systems for more complicated plumbing services, hotels, laboratories, rest homes, apartments, those sort of things, and even some fire stations in Christchurch. It's pretty much working in the AutoCAD space. We actually, interestingly enough, work for quite a few plumbers as well. We do a lot of white label work for plumbers that have design build work. And Flow Consulting came about because of a need to do something different. I really got sick of the tender market at one point in time. There was no point competing against everyone else. And I found that if you did design build orientated work, you didn't have to priced it in the open market. So it was a real good opportunity there. So now, particularly as the market's really heating up, a lot more people are looking to secure their pipeline of contractors and subcontractors. So design build comes back on, and that's where we do white label work, where we brand it for other plumbers in some cases. So that's my sales pitch. I won't do any more of that. Look, what else do I do? I have a few directorships, I suppose, and this led me to getting out of my business. Some people in their own companies get distracted. They get involved in the rugby club or in stock cars or in sport or other things. I got distracted in another business. I found myself getting dragged off on exciting, shiny things out the side when I should have been there doing my accounts and running my business and carrying on doing all the things that my board was telling me to do at the time, or my business coach at the time, whatever it was. And I found my way into governance and started from equivalent to like a school board, but then ended up getting involved in Waikato Institute of Technology, WinTech, on the council. And all those things really started to stimulate my thinking, and I realised that I really enjoyed that space, but it became quite distracting. So today, now that I'm freed up from my plumbing business, I'm on WinTech Council. That took me to Saudi Arabia last year, and I've just recently got back from China looking at our facilities over there. I'm the chairman of an optometry practice with 8 optometry retail shops and clinics around the country, including one in Newmarket up here in Auckland. And I'm the chairman of an agriculture consulting practice called Ag First, which are New Zealand's largest ag consulting organisation. And also chairman of a construction company, which is probably the closest thing where I came from. And the reason I'm demonstrating that is when we're plumbers building our own businesses, working in them, we actually pick up some amazing skills. And I've managed to transition those, like many of you will be, into other things. And I realised that it didn't really matter what organisation I was involved with. The things that you're talking about today, the activities you're doing around your staff and coaching and training and marketing and planning, everything you're learning with Tony, every business out there has those challenges. And so I find myself now talking to the optometry guys, the clinical people, about the very same things, but from a governance perspective, a compliance perspective. So we're really lucky as plumbers, electricians and builders and all you hear that building your own business, you get all these fantastic skills. Everybody has customers. They all have staff. They all have a brand to uphold and a bank manager and stakeholders, shareholders. So, back when I was, before I retired in CFRS, it started in pretty humble beginnings. I actually did my apprenticeship at CFRS Plumbing, which is a great story for me to share with people that I was looking to encourage into CFRS, and we still share with people that come on board through our training program there. I never wanted to be a plumber. My father was a plumber, and I actually had to work from every school holidays of my life, and I absolutely hated it. And as soon as I was old enough to leave my hometown of Tamaru, I said, bugger this, I'm out of here. I'm gonna go and do something else. But it wasn't too long before I found my way to getting a plumbing apprenticeship in Hamilton for CFRS Plumbing, which is the business I bought about six, 7 years later, and then ultimately went to buy the whole thing from the founder, Colin Rees. When I bought the business, it was pretty small. I only had 2 plumbers at that point in time. I was very lucky. It was the heyday when I was doing my training. We had about up to 25 guys. But I bought it when it dropped back down to 2, and I was one of the last ones, so I was almost like the last man standing. But we grew the business pretty quickly, and these days the vans don't look a little bit like that. I see my manager's got the guys driving around in brand new Amaroks and Transporter Volkswagens, and our brand is we're really proud of it, and we've trademarked all that stuff, and including the phrase, we can be there in 60 minutes, which is a service the guys offer. I'm proud of CFRS, and I absolutely love the company, but the point I'm getting across, I'm bloody glad I don't have to work there every day. And some of you might feel like that sometimes. This picture here is something that that I often go back to. Now, I'm not an Alice in Wonderland fan, but one day I got invited to go to a program just like this many years ago. I think I was about 26 years old. I'd missed the plane, not because I slept in. I missed the plane to go to this course in Wellington because I was up at 4 in the morning doing quotes. Missed the plane because I hadn't finished the quote and put it in the fax machine, whatever it was. I got down there and sat down in front of the group, and I don't think anyone's here from the group I was in, and said, had to do the introduction, so I missed my introduction. Well, hearing everyone else is sitting, I said, look, Aaron, I'm 26 years old, 27 years old, I've got 4 kids, got 25 plumbers working for me, panting still, don't know what the hell I'm doing, but I need help. And this came up on the slide a bit later in the session, and it's interesting, you know, forget the top bit about the cat, but the cat said, tell me which way I should go from here. That depends a good deal on which way you want to go. I don't much care, said Alice. Then it doesn't matter which way you go, and that's where I was exactly. I was working bloody hard. The bike was pedaling flat out, but I didn't really know which way I wanted to go. I didn't know what type of work I wanted to do, but I loved selling stuff. I loved getting business. So if a building company said, come to Auckland and do a subdivision up here, we came up here and did it from Hamilton. Wasn't a great idea, but we did it. If someone said, you should start selling water pumps or water filtration, we just did it because it was a great opportunity. It didn't really have a plan. I didn't know which way I was going. So out of that program that I was on, it's very similar to what you guys are doing. I think this is a lot better, a lot more comprehensive from what I've seen. One of the things I had to do was go away and get a mentor, get someone to help us. And we've heard this talked about today about mentors and people helping you in your business. And I just grabbed it because I was hungry. I needed help. I wanted to do things. I wanted to grow my business. I had these great visions. And I got this mentor person finally. One of the things we've got to be careful when we're doing this, there was a few months of procrastination in there, as happens, us plumbers. A lot of jobs come up, exciting things. But once I got over that, I got a mentor to come and help me. And one of the first things the mentor said is, Aaron, you don't really need coaching. You need some sort of formal process in place. So this leads me on to what I want to talk about, a board. And don't get lost with the concept of board and corporate world and that sort of thing. But really, I had the realization that I wanted to grow the business. But to grow it further or even to sustain it, I needed some help. I was really flying by the seat of my pants. I didn't really have any help. I needed this mentor to help me out. And what would happen to my company, or more importantly, my family's livelihood, if something had happened to me, if I had ended up on the grill of a bus or something? It was pretty much just glue holding together. So I started paying someone to ground me and marriage counselling me and put some delegated authorities and some process around me and to make me report and accountability. But success came from that. And I wanted to share a little bit about that. What we realised that we needed that coach, that mentor, but I needed it in a way of structure and process to make me do things. I needed someone to almost come in. And the person I met really saved me. I think, I don't know, I wouldn't be still going now if I was running as fast. At this age, I couldn't handle it. But what they said is, Aaron, you don't need control, but there's a real issue here. Your wife is a director of the company, and she's home raising these wonderful children, and she was working as well between that. But I wasn't sharing any of the information with her about the company, except the bad stuff. When she rang me up at 6:30 on a Friday night, where are you? You've been working, buddy, all hours. I haven't seen you all week. The kids want to see you. Want to go somewhere? And I'd just vent and I'd say, oh, Sarah, look, I'm just trying to get some money, and we've got this guy who owes us $100,000. He's got to pay us. We've got by wages. And she just went, ooh, $100,000. You know, she didn't know we were turning over probably about $4 million at the time. But it just focused in on that. This was a massive issue. 100 grand, oh, we're going broke. It's all going to, we're going to lose the house. I signed that guarantee. I'm a director of this. I'm responsible. She knew that. She's a very clever woman. And all we talked about the whole weekend would be that issue. We had no format, no way of discussing the governance matters of the business. So we're not talking about where the boys are going or what's happening, the governance, the actual big picture things. What are we doing? How safe are we? What's our plan? So this formed into an advisory board model where some structure started to be put around me. And this is something that some of you, if you're not doing it already, might consider as part of this process of working in your business over time. The structure meant I had to write a bit of a report about what I was doing. The structure meant I couldn't go and buy that new digger or that other friend of mine's plumbing company and amalgamated into mine like I was up to. I couldn't go and borrow more money without getting a sign off. I had some delegated authority put in place. Now, delegated authority is a really important part. It's a really fantastic tool for managers and for people, at no matter whatever level of the business. It means that you can give them a certain amount of rope and you know they won't go too far. So this was to stop me going too far. And I had some accountabilities. I had to get focused on getting the debtors up to date. I had to get the P&L right and reporting sorted, and had to work on my staff and do my job as the manager of the company, the managing director. And we had some success. It paid off. Within a few years, we'd won the Master Plumber of the Year, which I'm still incredibly proud of this. In fact, it's only about 10 years after that we took the stickers off our vans because it was 10 years old. I reckon you can get 10 years out of a good win. So any of you who won any great awards, promote the hell out of 10 years. We did it. It was hugely successful. We leveraged off that and went on to enter our local Westpac Business Awards. And at the time, our business won the Service Excellence Award for Waikato, which was fantastic. Up against law firms and accountants and other professional services, we won the Service Excellence Award. And that same year, which was a real honour, I won the CEO of the Year Award. So I was a pretty shit-hot manager at that point in my mind. CEO of the Year as a tradesman, you know. But I was still sneaking out and working on the tools and doing these things, and I should have been working on my business. So a bit of time went by, and we basically started to sort of get a bit complacent. We'd had this success, and things sort of started to change. You know, I started to slip back into my old habits. So we needed to step it up a gear. And this lesson for me is really about the realisation when you're outgrowing your trusted advisors. We all have different people that advise us, lawyers, accountants, friends. And as over time on your journey, you grow and develop, and you need to refresh those. And we shouldn't be afraid to do that. So I had to find a way to tell this fantastic person that led us through the success that, I'm sorry, I don't need you anymore. I need someone who's going to really push me a bit harder. I know your tricks. I used to feel like I was paying you to ground me, and I'd be scared when you come in for the advisory board meeting, but now I know what you're going to ask me, and I'm ready. So I wasn't getting the benefit. I needed to be pushed harder again. So we went through a process of saying, let's make a formal board. By this stage, we had about 45 guys. I had a good management structure in place, and we're right in the middle of an expansion plan. I had a branch in Auckland that I'd started, one in Tauranga, one in Cambridge, and I had a whole bunch of guys within my business I was getting ready to franchise off segments of my business to. I thought, this is great, I can do it. This is where I want to go. Or where I should go, actually, not where I wanted to go, because I didn't really know where I wanted to go still. I hadn't found that out. So how do you go about finding the right person to become a director of your company who's not going to be a shareholder? It's pretty easy, actually, to sell a few shares to one of your staff. I've done that. It's a great way to do it. But when you go to someone, a professional director, who's from the corporate world, wherever they are, that aren't a friend, that aren't a bank manager or a colleague or an accountant or a lawyer or a brother or a brother-in-law or sister-in-law, how do you ask them to come and join your company? Who would want to be a director of my plumbing company? Little plumbing company, it's not going to look great on their CV, is it? I know much different now. It does look fantastic on their CV. And what if they find out I don't really know what I'm doing? That's pretty scary. And what if my numbers could look better? I should put this off for a while until my numbers look better. We haven't really hit the budget. If I hit the budget and I exceed the budget, then we'll show someone our accounts. Because there's a real difference between that advisory board and bringing an independent director into the business. When I'm an advisor, I've got no responsibility. When you're a director of a company, you've got that legal responsibility, that fiduciary responsibility, and now with health and safety, you've got the health and safety responsibility. It's serious stuff. But I found someone. There was a lot of fear along the way. The fear of handing over control to this formal board. Because when you put a board in place, I became an employee of my own company. What if I chose the wrong person? The challenge, what if the new board members don't know the business very well and don't know where I want to go? What if I lose control? Well, you actually gain control through the process. And I soon learnt that having a board in place was a next level support for my organisation. What I needed, I was craving it. I'd experienced it in some of my other roles. By that stage, I was getting involved in some other governance. And that board actually meant I wasn't as lonely. I could drag those board members in when I was hiring that next senior staff member. I could drag them in if I had an issue. I could ring them up on a Friday night and say, just had a hard day, what do I do here? I knew what to do, as we all do, but we need someone to talk to. And the board helped me with that process. And it was a formal thing. The board member had to answer the phone. They had to be there to support me because they're equally responsible for the role. I ended up getting two board members, actually, by default. And this is another good experience. I found someone I wanted to become a director of my company, and I approached them. It was a guy who had started, I owned a hire business in New Zealand, Australia, had about 100 branches. And I thought, that's great, I want to be like him. I'll do that with my plumbing company. He said to me, it's just you and your wife for the directors, shareholders? He said, well, I don't want to be a marriage counsellor, so you better get someone else. So I ended up getting another person. But the director actually worked for free. I didn't pay them. I paid one of them, but not the other. So there are a lot of people out there that are happy to do this sort of thing at really low cost. Or no cost in my case, to help set things up, because it is good being part of a plumbing company. It's an exciting industry, and they saw that. One of the things, though, again, the scenery and conditions change, so you must do the same with your governance operation. You're not stuck with the same travelling companions all the time. As a shareholder of the company, you appoint the directors, and you can also remove them, and you need to keep that in mind. You're not stuck. Travelling companions is a key thing. I like to think of a director of the company or an advisor like a travelling companion, someone that's there with you. What's keeping you awake at night should be keeping them awake. Because it's important. Life is the cruelest teacher. First it gives the test and then the lesson later. In lesson one, lack of planning is the single biggest reason for failure. In lesson two, which is important to me in a family business, most family businesses are short-lived, less than 15% survive to be managed by the third generation and only 1% reach the fourth generation. It's a real issue. And it's an issue for a number of reasons, because my business is a family business. I want it to be in my family for many years, like it was with Colin Rees beforehand. It was started in 1946. But if we don't plan, planning is the key thing to ensuring that your business will continue on and do the right sort of things. Now that leads me on to why would you plan, and what is the difference between planning as a manager of the business or as a shareholder? And I think it's really important to understand, and I heard this touched on before, a couple of you said earlier, what do we want to do? We need to think about what we want. And this is exactly what I'm going to cover off now. It's important to understand the shareholders' expectations, which are a really essential part of setting strategy. How do you know which way to go unless you've asked the shareholders what they want? How did I know that I should have gone off and started those branches and grown my business to this unworldly size at the time, beyond my capability probably, without going and checking the shareholders? I never check with the shareholders. I just thought it would be a good idea. Now, SMEs, like us, make up about 97% of New Zealand businesses. And most SMEs are operated by individuals, partnerships or trusts. I know mine's definitely operated by a family partnership or trust. And we're all wearing three hats. Typically, we're a shareholder in the business. It's our single biggest investment in the organisation with the most risk. You know, we have money invested in houses and property, pretty safe investment, but your business is the single biggest risk and largest investment in a lot of cases. We're a director of the company charged with setting the strategy and overseeing the business and holding management to account. Often those management are us as well, so that's an easy one to get away with. We also have all the responsibilities and legal obligations that come with that, even more so now in a lot of the health and safety legislation. And we're part of the management team, so it's a really good way to bluff your way through and say, I'll talk to the shareholder and we haven't hit the budget, we'll get away with it. I'll talk to her tonight on the pillow, or we'll have a meeting, family meeting, and say, well, we're not going to hit the budget, it's been a tough year. Well, we bought that, but we've got that new ute. Well, we went on that trip to Fiji. So it's really easy to put all three hats on at the same time and accept, average performance, or accept the way it is, the way the market's driven you. You know, we had a recession, or that builder fell over and we lost some money, without really stripping it back and saying, what do we want this business to do? So what I learned from that process, and it took me a lot of years, I believe it's really important as a shareholder, we really articulate what we want out of our investment. Take those other hats off. Take off the fact that you work in the business and the ute sitting outside or back at the airport where you're from is a company vehicle, and that's a good perk, and that everything in your house is probably paid for by the company. Think about what you want out of your investment, the single biggest risk. What are your expectations over the coming year for your investment? Like it's an investment in another company or in some other asset. What do you want in the next 3 years, 5 years? What's your appetite for risk? How risky do you want to be with that investment? You're prepared to roll the dice and throw it in the market somewhere? Gamble it. What's your appetite for risk? What's your long-term expectation for the business? Is there a long-term plan? I never really planned to retire and get out of my business at 40, but I knew I never wanted to leave the business. I didn't see myself preparing it for sale. At this stage of your life, how much effort do you want to put in? How many of us have said, I'd really like to knock back to 4 days a week? That'd be great. I want to do more fishing. How many of you have said that? Should have said it so many times and not done it. Let's see. I need to read this over here. What level of dividend do you want? This is a good one to get away with. This is a great thing to say, oh, we don't need to get dividend. We've got a salary. We've got that trip to Fiji and that new ute and you. Kids have got fuel cards and company phones. And what's a long-term thing? Would you ever consider selling shares down? Is that new apprentice you're hiring that's otherwise going to go out on their own, are they a potential person to come in? And would you be happy giving them a small piece of the pie to make the pie bigger and then have input into the company at a different level? All these things I think we need to consider as a shareholder. The biggest thing is what level of dividend am I happy with? Because I think we should get our salaries and our director's fees as well as our dividend as shareholders. Not just in the good times. We've got to build a business model that delivers that at all time. And there'll be times when the business can't support it, but you've got to do everything you can to build that into the strategy. So how do you figure this out? I've got a little task for you shortly, and it's something that someone did to me a few years ago. I still didn't get it when they did this task with me. Our board chairman would always say every year before setting the budgets, we want the shareholders to have a meeting and come back to the board and tell us what we want to do. We want to just carry on. We're going to have 10% more than last year. That'd be fine. Yeah, just keep going. Make it a bit safer, lower the overdraft. Maybe try and get some of the personal guarantees removed. That'd be great. So I think it's really important to take some time out. And so what I'd like you guys to do, everyone to do, is take a piece of paper, and you've got a really clear mind here. Think only as a shareholder. I'll talk you through the process and we'll start it. Take a piece of paper and draw a stick figure style picture of your life in 5 years' time. There's no prizes for great artwork. How do you articulate what it looks like? What does the picture look like? What types of things are in the picture? What's not in the picture? And great if you've got your partners here, husbands, wives here. But if not, you can try this at home once you've practiced it. Now, before you start, think big picture. Don't think like you're constrained to what's happening today. Your business can do anything within reason. Your business can do anything. If everything was working right, when Tony's finished implementing all these fantastic strategies and supporting you, and you know it's going to be around, what's it going to look like? Not the business so much, what's your life going to look like? What will the business, your investment, enable you to do? So let's take 5 minutes, and then we'll see if anyone's brave enough to share that thinking. If anyone's got any questions, they can ask me. But draw a picture of your life in 5 years' time. What does it look like? What's in it? What's not in the picture? It's quite important to do this on a regular basis, and I think it's quite good to do it separately to your husband or wife as well, and just then compare them. Are there any surprises? Anything you've drawn there with that thinking? And I know it's only just the first cut at it. It takes a little bit of time to get your head in the right space. Any surprises? Anything that you've drawn that might require some extra effort or shift in focus in order to deliver what I now call the shareholders' expectations? This is your picture. And has your expectations shifted over time? Anyone's expectations shifted over time from what your thinking was before to what it might be today? And it's hard if you haven't done this before, but it's a key thing. Our expectations do shift over time. What we want today doesn't mean we're going to want it tomorrow, as in terms of our delivery of our life or how we want our life to look. Does anyone want to be brave to share or try and articulate what they're doing? You don't have to hold the picture up, but one of the key things about this process is to take that kind of real quick, without thinking, brain dump down that you've drawn in that stick figure. What does it actually mean? What does it look like? So what you've drawn, what's your life look like in 3 to 5 years' time? And what might you have to do to make that happen? Great. We've got a volunteer.
Yeah. I was just having like clear divisions within the company. So the lines aren't blurred anymore, like between management, office, divisions within the company, be it like the work side of it. With that sort of clear, you know, having, for example, maintenance division, the new build divisions, the gasoline.
Just having clear divisions within the company, from top to bottom, you know, from management, from shareholding point of view, to also just like succession plan, like you identified, actually talking the same thing, having, you know, these key people, which JT Plumbing Gas mentioned as well, you spot these guys that work for you, and you don't want them to, they can work for themselves and become your competition, or they can be integrated through your business.
Yeah.
All of these things, but having it's all hearsay until you make it happen. So you've got to get these lines nice and clear, you know, make that structure.
Yeah, good. It's starting to feel a little bit to me like a director hat, management hat picture. Which is fine, we'll get there. But how's that gonna benefit you personally as the shareholder, as the investor in the business?
Yeah. Then we can.
So you don't.
Most of my pictures are actually of funding salute.
Yeah, that's the key thing. I think it's important to have those pictures of funding salute. No, I'm not one of these guys that has a picture of my new boat on the fridge, but it's about actually spending this time thinking about, I've got this investment in the company, I want it to deliver this, enable this for me. I'm not worried about what it is. It's good though. Anyone else got anything they want to throw in there?
Well, spookily, my husband and I both drew without seeing 6 investment properties.
Fantastic.
So
that's a great shareholder one. So,
yeah. And travel.
Yeah, so the business, your investment in the business has got to enable the purchase or the development of those 6 properties and the travel.
Yeah, and that will go to our passive income and leisure time.
Yep. So on that, do you think there's anything, and you don't have to disclose anything, but do you think there's anything that you might have to shift the effort or the focus to be able to deliver that within that 3 to 5 year time, those 6 properties? Has this come back to really looking at the business and saying, well, with the shareholders have set their expectation, we now need to do this in the business to better deliver that?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. But it's now sitting down and working out what that is.
Yeah. Very good. Anyone else?
Actually, it surprised me. I've never thought about it before, but after listening to you and everything, I think, you know, with Jason and the business and now I'm coming into it, but I'm thinking, well, when we've got our free time, I want to create my own business. I want to have something that I can, you know, that I'm passionate about. So it doesn't mean you have to make money or anything, or be nice, but, you know, something that I want to do and business-wise.
Excellent. That's great. So you want this business to better not only give you free time, but to give you the capital, ideally, to start your own business.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Brilliant. I'm going to show you mine in a minute. Is anyone else itching to share these? Must have one more over this side. Martin must have something good.
I've just got a couple of golf carts and they're popping in every now and then to collect some rent. I've got 12/365 with me sitting around a table in my business, and I've drawn a little plane.
Excellent.
To jump on every now and then, not for me to fly or something, but
fantastic. So the whole point of this type of thinking is to get us thinking as shareholders, so that when we start our business planning cycle, and if anyone's like me, it starts now in our businesses at this time of the year. We've got a March, April, first of the financial year. So we're starting now thinking about our business planning. When I talk about business planning, I don't mean about just doing the budget to give it to the bank manager or to the other shareholders. The business plan, what feeds into that? What do we want out of it? How much money? So to get that plane and that time off and those rental properties, what level of dividend do you need over time to better take out of the business for it to enable you to achieve your personal goals as a shareholder, or your goals as a shareholder, for your investment? Because we've all got a lot of money invested in our businesses, and we've definitely put a lot of time. I'm a firm believer we should be paid for every minute of time we put into our business once it's set up and running, because our employees are getting paid. But we need more than that. We need that dividend payment, all that time, that flexibility, all that succession. I'll share with you my one. I'm going to share my one from back when I first did it, this first exercise back in 2002. Now, I'm not an artist, as you can see, but the key part's not the drink, it's about articulating it. So when I articulated this to my wife back then, and she hit me, this was supposedly a picture of New Zealand and a bit of a picture of the South Island. It's breaking it, don't worry, Martin, I wasn't going to get to the South Island. But a whole lot of vans, a big CF Reece head office at the time, we were leasing a building. I had a bunch of staff there, and then four vans times 10, so that's a lot of vans, isn't it? And then I was in Auckland, and I was in the Bay of Plenty and people, and so it's all about growth. Now this is my personal picture then. This was when I first did this exercise. This is not a shareholder's picture, is it? This is the bloody manager of too big an ego that drew that picture. But that's what I was thinking. That's where I was. That's where my mindset was. And Sarah was home raising her kids and never seeing me.
How long ago was that?
That was 2002, I think it was. I think, yeah. 2002, about then, yeah. 2 years before we won the Master Plumber of the Year. So I drew that picture then. And you know, when we'd started our franchise program, which my board very quickly reined back in and said, let's just make that Auckland one a pilot franchise and let's measure it for a while and see if this is what you actually want to do. As it turned out, I didn't want to own a franchise plumbing companies around the place, because it was a bloody hard job. And you offer all these great services from our head office to people, and it's this whole fee, wee thing, you know, it was all fee, and you need a bit of wee so you can get the glee out the bottom of the curve. You know, we were providing some services. Our guy in Auckland was making a lot more money than we were in Hamilton. And the cracks were showing. We were growing so fast. We didn't have the basic stuff right. And now I find myself using a term that I do a lot with people where I sit on the board when we're talking about strategy. Are we squeezing every last bit of juice out of the orange before we take that next expansion? Are we running at full production? Are we getting maximum return for what we're doing at the moment before we stretch out and invest more money? So that was my picture. This is my wife's one sitting next to me, so you can see why I got hit. Same time. The scary thing was, I think we had 5 kids then, and there's 8 on that picture. She knew something I didn't know. Fiji, a home. I think we're living in a rental home still. Everything was going into the business. I had no intention to buy a house. Any spare cash, bought another digger. Aeroplane, tropical island. We were totally poles apart. No wonder we were having trouble. And we're obviously having a lot of kids, we're having that much trouble, but but we weren't in alignment. She's the shareholder and director of the company, equal to me, but I was the rogue CEO running it. This was actually before we put our formal board in place. This is when the first advisor was there. So these days, we go to Fiji every year with the family. We've got a couple of homes, one on each coast, and Sarah does a lot more travel than me. So see who won. We aren't in Auckland, we're not in the Bay of Plenty, and I haven't even got my job anymore. So the things change, and it's interesting. I make that point because we realised we had to sort of get better alignment. Business partners, fellow shareholders, directors of this company, life partners. We had to get alignment because I couldn't just carry on what I was doing. The whole thing was going to fall apart. She would have left me and taken the five kids or whatever it was and left me with the business, and I would have burnt out and had a heart attack. But things changed over a while, time. Once I went through that whole, your plan of growing and expanding your business isn't the right plan, and once I realised that I didn't really know what I wanted, when I started to understand what I wanted, I started to realise that, I suppose as you get older, you lose a bit of energy, you lose a bit of focus, some other things pop up, other opportunities, you start to shift. So my plan started to shift quite a bit. Now, I haven't drawn this, and it's not walking the talk, but I haven't drawn this recently, but I can tell you what it says today. I don't want a lot of people in my direct report. I got sick of having 45 odd people in my company and a management team of four or five and dealing with all the issues and wondering what they were doing and worried about when it rained. I just got kind of burnt out with it. So I went from being that CEO of the year kind of person that thought he was a great manager to just my focus shifted. And it shifted subtly. I started getting interested in other things. I started to get people asking me to invest in other businesses, and I did a couple of startups, which I absolutely loved. I got invited to go and help other people on their boards, and I started to love governance. And my picture now looks like a helicopter, not because I have a helicopter or want one, because I like to be in the helicopter space. I love strategy. I love thinking about the big picture. And I really identify that I hate the doing. No wonder I've really struggled managing my own business, because when you manage your own business, if you have an idea, you've got to bloody implement it. Well, you've got to find something to implement it. It's not that easy when you haven't got a big corporate organisation to implement it. You have a great idea like going to fixed price billing or whatever it may be, or templating something. You've actually got to get in and work the hard yards. And I loved doing that when I was first started in business, but I got tired of it. And I no longer was the right person to be running the company in that case, or growing it. So how do you translate those shareholders' requirements into the business's strategy? This is the hardest part, because you've got to keep that shareholder's head on as you're doing it. You've got to make sure you've got that very clear. So I think it's really important that the shareholders present the agreed translation of their collective shareholders' expectations to the board. So this is us at home around the kitchen table in some cases, putting the shareholder's head on, then taking that and then keeping that on, and then telling yourself with your director's head on what you want, or if you're fortunate like myself with independent advisors in the board, telling them. So this is what I want. I want those rental properties. I want those investments. I want those Fiji holidays. Right, great, Aaron, how much money do you need to do that? When will you need it? How can we build a business model that will deliver that? And you've got to be realistic. But you've actually got a plan. You've got to set those goals, as it won't happen. You'll have another bad year. Things will be rough, and you can make those excuses. But you got the new ute, and you had the holiday. And the kids have got cell phones from the company, and maybe a fuel card. So I think the key thing is spend 30 minutes before any strategic discussions talking to the board, that's yourselves with your director hat on, about what you want. And then as directors of the company, with the support of the management, that's your senior manager in the company, implement the strategy. Only then can you get what you want as a shareholder, as an investor, because it's flowed right through from the shareholder's expectations, right through into the board strategy, the governance, and then into the management they're doing. But only then can you make it happen. It might happen by chance, and there's a lot of successful people that happens by chance. But if there's anything different that changes, this is how you can implement it. For me, when we did that the last time, it was a bit of a come to Jesus moment. We're just coming out of the tail end of the recession. I'm an entrepreneur. I love growing things, love shiny stuff, buying new diggers, starting up new businesses. And I'd gone through a few years of really having to batten the hatches down. Had to scale my business back several people to fit the size. Took out our whole housing side of the company. We used to do about 75 houses at any one time in our housing team, and that whole thing disappeared overnight with the recession. And we kept on going, but it wasn't me. I couldn't do it anymore. And I actually, the issue was I wasn't delivering on my job as the CEO of the company. The board was hammering me. And we went through this and said, this is the strategy. So as the shareholder, yes, I want this. I want this level of dividend. The business should be able to deliver this. It should be able to fund all my kids going to university. It should be able to pay for our next beach house. As a director, I said, yeah, we can build a business model around this. The management can implement it. The market's coming good. But as a CEO, I looked at it and said, I can see why you guys are doing this, but it's not me. I haven't got the gas left in the tank. My passion's not there. There's something shiny over here I want to go and chase. I want to go and start something up. So I was the wrong person to be running the company. The realization. So my chairman said to me, Aaron, you have to sell two things. You have to sell straight away. Hey, Colin Reese would turn in his grave if he thought I was selling his business. He's entrusted this with me to run it. And I love this company. I just hate my job. And the problem is when you own your own business, you're stuck in that job typically. Unless it's in growth mode and your job changes and you bring new managers, and that's pretty inspiring. But when it's in sort of management mode and you're trying to hit those KPIs and all the things that Tony's going to be encouraging you to set, sometimes you can just hit that rut and you think, that's not me anymore. I want to do something different. It doesn't mean the business isn't great. It just means maybe you're not the right person to run it. And I wasn't the right person to run the business at the stage it was, because my desires, I'd shifted. And I wasn't going to sell. So could someone else possibly run my business? So that's where the succession bit kicked in. So what we did in the end is we went out and recruited for a general manager with the support of my advisors and some knowledge about an earlier attempt that I had of doing that 4 years earlier. We recruited a general manager and I left the business within a month and moved to a home office. Bloody hardest thing I ever did. Now the reason I did that, left the business, because I'm a pretty interfering kind of manager, business owner. And about 4 years earlier, I'd put a GM into my business and I'd never left the building. And everything the poor guy did, even though he was the right guy, I overruled. If he didn't do it exactly the way I did it, and some of you might be guilty of that, I'm not pointing any fingers, but often we are, us tradesmen. We overruled. If my staff saw that, they knew if the manager wanted them to do something and they didn't like it, they could go around him and come to me and I'd sort it out. So I never left, so I was never actually gave up that responsibility because I knew everything, I was the best. So when I did it the second time, I deliberately didn't. And the second time I was leaving the business, it was structured better in terms of for that. And I deliberately didn't hire a plumber. And in my senior management team in the past, some of my best managers have not been plumbers. Some of the best ones have been women actually, that have come in, the best organisers, multitaskers. And because they're not plumbers, it often makes them the best managers because they're not technical. They can't get in that spare van or in their ute or their company car and shoot out and fix that bloody emergency for the best client. They have to manage, they have to plan. They only know about the business. So when I look forward to today, I couldn't be happier. I own this fantastic company, getting my dividend payments. I'm not the leader of it. When it's something's in the paper about it, it's not me, the Aaron Rink, CEO of the company. I'm over that now. I've got my head around that. But it's run by a great team of people, and he's built a better management team than I'd built at the time, and he's more focused on the aspects of the business that pay the return to the dividend and building the team, because he's not a technician, he's a professional business manager. And we only have 25 guys working for us today, a smaller business returning more than it was with 45 without me being involved. He's a better guy at running it than me. Now that's a bloody hard pill to swallow. There's someone better at running your company than you are. I've got over it. So the come to Jesus moment. So how do we do that? How do I stop getting my hand smacked? I got my hand smacked plenty of times when I moved out. I used to sneak back in there, used to dial and look at the accounts and interfere, and the odd customer would ring me and try and go around the manager, and my board would smack me pretty hard. And we had an open thing where I could say the manager could actually get stuck into me even though I owned the company if I interfered, and it's a good culture to have. He used to go to my chairman and tell on me, but then we eventually got to the point where we could have that honest, you know, growing up big boy conversation. Hey, you're no longer running this company, Aaron. You've entrusted me to do it. I own the P&L. I'm responsible. If I deliver, you'll give me the bonus. If I don't, you'll smack me. So get out of the way and let me do my job. They're the kind of conversations we had. But what gave me comfort was we always had good reporting processes in this latter years, not in the early days, not in the seat of the pants days. But financial KPIs and non-financial KPIs and health and safety KPIs are a key thing I want to talk about now. How can you step away from your company and know that it's in good hands. Now, this doesn't matter whether you're stepping away from your company entirely like I did, or you're just giving a division of your company to someone to run, or you're entrusting a new manager. They've got to have some reporting, some KPIs, some guidelines as to what success looks like, or where you can know that things are running well within the parameters you set without going and interfering and empowering them to get on with the job. So I wanted to just touch on some of these, and Tony asked if I had any dashboards and things that I could show. Well, look, you can get fancy dashboards like this, and this is just one I took from the internet. But for reporting, I think it's simple to have it in a dashboard, but it doesn't have to be a fancy dashboard. What are the key things that make the boat go faster that you want to measure? So I want to talk a little bit about the best ways to look at that from a governance perspective. Now, this is governance as you directors, shareholder directors, looking at your business yourselves with your director hats on. Back home at the kitchen table, when you're well away from work. KPIs, dashboards, whatever you like, need to be simple and measurable. Only measure what matters, and make sure the information is easy to produce. If you're getting stuff coming out of your job management system, out of Fergus, out of Simpro, Xero, whatever, use that. Don't go and try and make some highfalutin management thing. It has to be easy to produce consistently the same way. And I've heard it today, share the information. Great to hear that you're sharing that information with the team, because it affects them. There's no point having these reports and not looking at them, or worse, not sharing them with the team and compare it, make it comparable. So if we look at a couple of these reporting kind of measures, and this is me, how do I feel comfortable owning my company, being responsible for it as a director, but not in control of it? So you've got your standard stuff, but I'm a firm believer, and it doesn't matter when I'm in the optometry practice, I want to see the same thing. I want to see these items here for the month, year to date, and to the last year, to budget. Each of these items in a little table, once you produce it, you can keep doing it. You can get it off the bottom line as zero, that's fine, but if you've got a structure, you can create a format where that information can be taken straight from those reports and put into a table that the manager might report on, for example. Sales, cost of sales, gross margin, overheads, net profit, debtors, creditors. Debtors and creditors are really important when you're stepping away, keeping an eye on those. Our debtors ledger at CF Reece looks better than it ever did with me not there. Everyone I knew on that ledger, they were my friends, colleagues, people I built relationships. Owners of companies are the worst people for following their own processes. I was good at putting processes in place, but I wasn't good at following them. And the worst people for chasing debtors where they have relationships. So I've learned to let other people do that. It's their job. It's less emotional. And then, of course, the non-financial KPIs. This is the important stuff. And this is really what makes the boat go faster. What matters? These are some things that we look at in our plumbing company, but no different to optometry, to the other businesses, to WinTech. Number of new clients. If we're in a growth mode, or we've got a plan, if part of our strategy to deliver the shareholders' expectations is to grow the number of clients because we want to increase our market share, we've got to measure it. We've got to have a base point. We've got to know what the budget is to do it. How many new customers do we want to win this month? How are we tracking to last year in terms of new clients coming on board? What I've missed from there is client retention, but it's a little bit harder to measure in the trades. Number of jobs logged. If you're not there, you're away on holiday, it'd be nice to look on your smartphone and see how many jobs are logged today. And we can do that with a lot of the apps out there these days. And then the type of job targeted. Really important, I think, with all the work out there that's available, what kind of work do we want to grow? I know in my plumbing company, we don't want to grow big tender work anymore. You know, probably 30 of those guys that I had at one point were working on commercial sites, retention-based stuff. We probably had 100 grand in retentions quite easily at any point in time, and that's horrible. But we now want to grow maintenance work, facilities maintenance work, ongoing contracts where we do the sale once and we get that repeat business ongoing. And we put that strategy in place, and now we have a maintenance contract for the DHB and Fonterra and Transpower and those types of things that continually feed work back into our business, like rental property companies or whatever it may be. Why keep repeating the sales process? So it's important to target that stuff. So what do you want? We like to measure call-outs because that's where we get work from other plumbers. Because they're not doing the call-outs, we're getting them, and we can go back and win those clients. And we put the effort into 24/7 guaranteed service. And they're higher GP work often, those things. Jobs not yet issued, live jobs. It's important to know how many jobs are sitting there that haven't been allocated to anyone if someone's responsible. How many jobs are still live in our pipeline? How many jobs are finished but not yet invoiced? That work in progress is a terrible bloody thing to manage in a trades orientated business sometimes. And rework and invoice disputes, the callbacks. So I can feel quite comfortable not being in my business other than in a monthly or meeting when I'm getting that on my dashboard, you know, that dashboard that we saw there, that type of thing. But it can equally be in a spreadsheet as long as it's updated in real-time relevant information. And then you get into quotations. Big thing, if you're doing quotes, I don't like doing quotes. I think it's a terrible thing. How many people here charge for quotations? Great. How much do you charge for a quote?
We charge for the consultation. We should have about $75 to go out for a consultation.
Fantastic. That's absolutely brilliant. It's ridiculous in this market, I think, to be doing free quotes for anyone. You sell a quotation, a consultation, and what you can do is we make that a refundable consultation fee. So if you accept the quotation that may result from that consultation, we refund that money back. I'm working with a housing company at the moment where I'm on the board of, and that housing companies are shocking for this. They have all these, you can go and go to a group housing company and say, here's your off the shelf plan, and I want a room here and I want a garage there and I'd like to put it on this site. They'll come out on your site and they'll look at it, they'll do all this free work. A firm that I'm involved with that, I said, we can't take the work. What are we spending all this time chasing this stuff up? And we've got a strike rate of about 20% or 30%, we're competing against everyone else. I said, let's start charging for quotes. For consultations. They charge $1,800 for a consultation. The strike rate's 100%. They're only spending their time with the customers that want to go ahead with the work, the serious customers, no more tire kickers. The team's much happier. Real important stuff if you are quoting, I think, and this is what I like to look at as well, how many quotes have we sent? How many quotes have we won? How many have we lost? What's that pipeline? And a thing called the forward order book. I don't know if anyone use a forward order book. It's a good matrix to know whether you need to keep pricing, whether you've got enough work in the forward order. Forward orders are accepted work, not yet invoiced. Great thing to have on your little reporting system. It changes every month, so if you've got a contract and you do half of it, that drops down, another one has to come in. If the forward orders start diminishing below a certain threshold, you know, CF Resale, our forward order threshold used to be $2 million at one point in time. It's a lot less these days because we're not interested in chasing that long-term work. We'd rather have lots of smaller jobs so we can keep up with the changing market. And the sales pipeline, how many quotes have we sent out that accepted? Particularly if you're taking your eye off the ball a little bit or you're stepping away from the business, you know, have we got plenty of good things in the pipeline that are likely to be accepted? The last one, which often people measure, and I used to hang my hat on this, team productivity. I actually think in this market, it's one of the worst things to measure, within reason. Unused capacity is better. We used to measure team productivity in our business, and we actually found it reduced the amount of new opportunities we had. We actually would get the tradesmen and we'd say, right, you've got to be 98% productive or 95% productive. But what they did, they only went to that one job. They didn't look for anything extra. They didn't upsell. They just stayed focused. It sort of sent a bit of had a negative effect. So it's important to make sure you're not overly fixated on some of these KPIs, because sometimes productivity can be at the cost of new opportunities or better customer service. And it did affect us, so we've throttled back on it. Health and safety, really important. Near misses, LTIs, this is all pretty standard stuff, but I'm seeing this come through in my dashboard, so I know things are okay. Near misses, open actions, close out audits, really important. Auditing the processes, auditing the jobs, the toolboxes. Not on every job, but just knowing that these things are kind of happening. That gives me comfort when I've stepped away. So that's the end of my ramble. Audit. So closed out actions. So open actions are when there's an investigation underway or you're doing a review on something, someone does an near miss. The near miss happens and you have to investigate it. What's the risk? Could this happen again? Is it a telltale of something that could lead to an incident? And then that's an open action when it's closed out and finished, you've got the outcome from it. You know, how many things that we want to look at, we're getting a lot of issues with hand cuts. So do we need to do some more training with the team on that? So as a director of the company, if we're seeing those sort of incidents coming through, or with little near misses of pipe flying off the roof of the vans when they go up to the traffic lights, that's a near miss. The tradesman should be, the apprentice should be filling out a near miss form. It's an accident that happened, or a near miss. It's a near accident. But then our roof rack's not right. The tie down's there. Do we need to provide training to all those new apprentices that are tasked with that? So these are the telltale things that help. So whether it's health and safety or business performance, it's all the same kind of indicators, really. So that's me. One of the key things, that's the three hats. I can't sort of reiterate that enough. Make sure you've got your shareholder hat on for a reasonable amount of the time. Think about what you want out of the business. Plan it, revisit that picture. On the boards that I sit on, I get my shareholders now, I've learnt, to report back before we start the strategy session every year. They have to do that picture again. And they have to come back to me as the board chairman and tell me what it is, articulate it. Now, when you've got two or three shareholders, it even gets more complicated. One of the ones I've done recently, I found there was three different shareholders. One of them was the MD, who was the more mature one of the company. He effectively said on his one, look, I've decided I might retire next year. We just automatically thought someone else would step up and run the business. They said, I've decided I want to focus more on this side of the business. I don't want to get bogged in management. So we're left with no one to run the business. So it comes out, if they didn't have that shareholder discussion, it could have led to some conflict or some issues. So it's quite a key element to that strategy. So thank you very much for listening to me. Thank you.